Okay, as we continue in our study here of the Sermon on the Mount, we've looked at some of in discussing the contrast that Jesus has here at the latter part of Matthew chapter 5, we looked at some of the seeds that we want to be aware of, the seed of anger, and how that, if it's not properly addressed, can lead to murder. Not in all cases, obviously, but it can. The anger in and of itself is not wrong, but what anger can lead to can be sin. And we looked at lust as a seed that can lead to adultery. And if we strive not to participate in, accommodate lust in our heart, we're going to be extremely long ways down the road to not committing adultery. We looked at the attitude toward divorce, the things that Jesus said about divorce, and basically, you know, there's a lot that we could say and a lot that we talk about today in the 21st century about that, but really it boils down to what Jesus said. If it's not for sexual immorality, it's not right. There was a sister here a couple weeks ago, and when we were talking about that did point out, and it's true, you know, adultery, sexual immorality does not mandate divorce, but it is the only cause that God will recognize as acceptable for divorce. If a person can, if an offended spouse or an innocent spouse can find in their heart to forgive and work with their relationship with their spouse, then, you know, they can basically move forward, potentially. It's just that oftentimes the trust that should be in a marriage has been so broken that there doesn't seem to be any way forward for the couple. We looked at the making or taking of oaths, and we looked at the words that were used by Jesus. He said not to swear, and we looked at that meaning that it's not talking about profanity. There's other places that talk about we shouldn't use profanity, but rather that's not to make a promise or take an oath or a vow without intending to keep it. And then as we continue on, as we had looked at those contrasts, notice for the one at murder, it says, you've heard that it was said to those of old. For adultery, you've heard it was said to those of old. Then with divorce, it was furthermore. So it's like he's adding on to that, thought about adultery. And then for oaths, you have heard that it was said to those of old. So those seem to be teachings that go way back, potentially back to Sinai or shortly after Sinai. Now we're getting into a section, two passages or two areas, and it just says, or what we read starting in Matthew chapter 5, verse 38, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. We're going to delve into that a little bit this morning. So he doesn't say to those of old. So as I read this, and I could be wrong, but as I read this, this may be something that has morphed. It's changed a little bit in its interpretation over time from what was originally planned, designed by God, to something else. So the original the references in Scripture for eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, we can look at Exodus chapter 21, verses 24 and 25, where we read eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, strike for strike. Okay, that's like, if this happens, then, you know, payback is the same. That's what it sounds like. Leviticus 24:20, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. Okay. Deuteronomy 19:21, your eye shall not pity you, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Again, so we read some passages in the Old Testament about that concept that Jesus says, you heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That became the shortened version, that kind of like the shorthand. Kind of like when you're in the military, you talk about people being AWOL. You know, away without leave. You don't always say out that long string. You just say those four letters and everybody knew what you were talking about. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Everybody knew what you were talking about. Or thought they did. The original intent of that, if you go back and look at the passages preceding those that I just read, just referred to, You're talking about the judgment, the punishment that judges were to mete out, that they were to prescribe. This was not supposed to be, if somebody does something to Bruce, that he has the right to go back and do the same thing to them. That's not the original intent. The original intent was, if somebody does something to Bruce, he takes it to the judges go, yeah, this person did that. They look at it, and it's in one of the passages says, not on the word of one witness only, but the word of two or three witnesses. The judges will look into the matter, and then they'll make a judgment. And then it reads, here's how you judges make your determination. Purpose of that, what could be a purpose of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth kind of concept? And as we read all those others, fracture for fracture, wound for wound, strike for strike, what might God's intention in having prescribed that as a judgment be? Bruce?
Well, in my study, what I've come to the conclusion of is he was trying to bring equity. Back before ancient times, you do something to me, I burn your village, take your children as my slaves, take your wife as my chattel. God was saying, if he comes over and kills your goat, go take his goat. There's an equity there.
Okay.
Not a total all out, let's burn the village, rape the women, and kill the cattle for everything they did. And that's kind of the way things were back, if you go back before Moses, back even before the Egyptians. Little slight, kill a village. And he was saying here, an equity. If he does this, then you get that, that's equal. And then Jesus comes on and says, no, it's even worse than that. It's if you think about doing it, you know, let it slide.
Okay.
I think too, under the Old Testament, when you use it, we still have laws today that is resemble the consequence of a crime or if you commit murder, generally, that's what you will be charged with. An eye for an eye is simply an expression that was used to show the result of what can happen before a judge system.
Okay.
If you steal a goat or kill it, why then penalty can result in the life of your goat.
Okay.
I mean, that seems to be, because when we say an eye for an eye, it doesn't mean that, like you said, I can go over there and punch a guy in the face because he did it to me.
Right.
There is a system that you go through in the Old Testament, and you brought it up, the judge system.
Okay.
In which you will see every crime that was committed, there is a penalty. And that is why you go before, and they are to investigate, truly. That's why you can't bear false witness or do it in these.
Okay. Yeah. And exactly right on both, I would say on both of those. Yeah. Now, not only, I'll come right over there. Not only was that common probably prior to the giving of the law, and these were included in the giving of the law. Not in the Ten Commandments directly, but in some of those other 600 plus commandments. But it probably was and is common in other cultures that made it different. But notice one of the things that Don pointed out, you know, the thing that we have in our day and age, the thing that we hear spoken anyway, is punishment to fit the crime. There's judges. Why are there judges? Some kind of an act, criminal act, has taken place. It might be a small one. They punched you in the nose. It might be a little bit harsher one. To end it.
Well, I was thinking that God put those in place to cause a person to think. You know, just like a child, if you say, if you do this, it's going to result in these consequences. And eventually, they learn to do right and wrong, but they also learn to love you. And it's just like you learn to love and say, I won't do this bad thing because I love my mom and dad enough
Okay. And it's a great point, because that was the next point I was going to make, is part of this was a preventative measure. If you think about it from God's perspective, talking to men who are oftentimes mankind controlled by emotion, you know, what's the first thing you want to do if somebody punches you in the nose? You want to double up your fist and punch them back. That's the first reaction that many people have. Maybe not everybody, but many people have that reaction, that initial response. And so then when you're carrying it beyond a punch in the nose to something a little bit more harsh, that's where, you know, if I do something to Mike and he takes me to court over it, I'm going to have the same thing happen to me. I might think twice before I do that. And so I believe that those are both the reasons that those were put into place.
Dave.
Go ahead.
There's another component here that you mentioned. The idea of it's not an individual responding to an individual. It's a societal response as a group to the individual that misbehaved.
Right.
A component of peer pressure, I guess.
Partially, and also establishing community responsibility, and both the responsibility of the community to protect the community, and the responsibility of an individual to the community. One of the things that it seems, now, again, we were talking original intent. Now, I believe that's why Jesus didn't say, you've heard it said to those of old, and then go on with his four examples, but he just said, you've heard it said. I think it devolved into personal retribution. We do read about in the Old Testament about the cities of refuge. What were those for? So if you killed somebody accidentally, you get to the city of refuge, because if you got inside the city of refuge, the avenger of blood, which was the nearest blood male kin to the person you killed, if they caught you outside the city of refuge, they had the right to take your life, to exercise life for life. So you get to the city of refuge, that person still comes up to their, hey, I got an issue about so-and-so. He killed my brother, my cousin, my dad, my whatever. And so the judges would investigate, they would hear, they would look into the matter, and then they would determine, was it accidental? Was it not? If it was not accidental, they would basically just go, here you go, life for life. But that was a judgment by judges for the community, so that someone who had committed evil, intentional murder, wasn't allowed to continue to live. It was basically turn them over for capital punishment, turn them over to the executor.
With that, even if it was an accidental death, there was still a penalty for the person that committed it.
Absolutely.
I mean, he may not forfeit his life, but
he kind of forfeited his freedom. He had to stay inside the walls of the city of refuge.
And if his family was somewhere else and his livelihood was somewhere else, I mean, he suffered some consequences.
Right. And again, we've talked about that a couple of times now. Remember that time frame was until the current high priest died. Now, by the time we get into Jesus' time, it seems like the high priest was an appointed position, maybe elected, I don't know, because we talked about Annas being a former high priest and Caiaphas being the high priest, or vice versa, for Jesus' trial. When God first established it, a person was a high priest until they died. Then there was, God would basically determine who was next in line. Ed, were you going to say something?
Yeah, this eye for an eye and all that does not apply to us today.
Okay.
This was before Jesus' death. Jesus, I think, is setting an example for us. He tells us, you know, that in days of old, we heard this, but I tell you that we this. What he's trying to teach us is that we are not to live like they lived back then. We're not under the law anymore. We're under Jesus.
Okay.
Crucifixion and resurrection. And he said, you know, like when he says, if someone slaps us on the face, what are we to do?
You're getting ahead of my lesson now.
Turn the other. If somebody asks you for your coat, take your cloak also. In other words, give more than they ask for. If you help somebody, don't expect to be repaid for it. That's the way we're to live today. We are to love each other like God and Christ loves us. And that's a mouthful right there. You know, that's sometimes hard to do, but we're to love our enemies. So
correct.
We are under a completely different set of rules.
And we're getting there. With all of that you just said, we're getting there. One last thing before we get there, in part of this devolving process, part of that was on the part was you got to lay at the feet of the rabbis. In doing my study, it had the situation, the interpretation of that law, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, fracture for fracture, all those listed, had devolved into personal retribution, had devolved into outcome-oriented, not injury-oriented. Let's say Alan's got one eye. I've got two. I do something to him that causes him to lose sight in his other eye. Now what is he?
Blind.
Totally blind. So if he gets to put out one of my eyes, or I have one eye put out as a result of the punishment, what does that leave me? One eye. So a lot of the rabbis were saying, no, the outcome is what's important. If I make Alan be totally blind, the only fair outcome is that I'm totally blind. So part of that was no escalation, as Bruce was talking about earlier. You're not, you know, somebody breaks your arm, you don't go raise their village. You don't, you know, kill all their cattle, etc. That was part of it. It had devolved into a personal retribution thing. Jesus has said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, I tell you not to resist an evil person. I think those next four things are his examples of what an evil person and how we should respond to them. If somebody slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek. So, and one of the things that's interesting about that, in the Jewish culture, and it may be still the way things are over the Middle East, the right hand is considered the superior hand, the superior side. The right eye, the right ear, the right foot. And think about, what did Moses anoint on Aaron at God's direction? The right thumb, right big toe, the right ear. Those were symbols in their culture, their society, of the superior side. So if somebody were to hit you on your right cheek, they're going to use their superior hand. Now, how am I going to hit, against since you're over here, I'm not going to hit you. But if I'm going to use Alan as an example, how am I going to hit his right cheek with my right hand, except to backhand him? To backhand somebody was an insult. It was treating them as an inferior. Treating them, because you can't get as much oomph into it, so it was more of an insult, saying, you're inferior to me. When it's saying, turn the other cheek, it's like, okay, if you're going to hit me as an equal. You know, that was part of it. But also, don't immediately respond with violence to violence. If somebody takes you to court, says, if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Interesting thing about this. Tunic. The Jewish people had basically four pieces of attire. A tunic, which they wore next to their skin, cloak that they wore over, sandals, and a sash or a belt. In their belt, you know, we read about Jesus saying, don't put money in your belt or whatever. That was it. Those are the four pieces of clothing. So if somebody says, I'm going to take your underclothes, and you say, okay, here's my coat too, what does that leave you? A sash that you probably tie low, and sandals. Basically, it sounds like somebody's taking, if you've got cattle, flock, vineyards, why would somebody take your underwear? I mean, think about it. They're taking the shirt off your back. You know, they're basically trying to take every single thing you have. And one of in the study I've done, part of what they said, the interpretation of this was, shame the person, show them how destitute they're trying to make you. You know, if they could at least let you keep your clothes. You know, and they didn't have a closet full of clothes.
How does that apply to us today?
I think it's the going the second mile, and it's the next one.
So if somebody sues me, I'm supposed to just say okay and settle? Because I'm sued once or twice a year. And nearly everybody's in business is sued once or twice a year. I got a woman that comes through the stores with a stick to walk around and make sure that you're doing it. If not, she sues you. She's not handicapped, but she likes to sue you. We've got people every year that come out and find the one little spot of ice in the parking lot and go lay on it. Fortunately, we have cameras, but it's a constant thing in this society. So if you do what it says right here, literally, you will live on the street.
I understand that.
So what are we supposed to do?
The consequence, I believe, or the teaching that we're supposed to get out of this is don't retaliate. You know, one of the translations I use three or four different translations: the New American Standard, New King James, which I have here, NIV, Revised Standard. This one says, "Go the second mile," as the little caption above this little section of scripture. One of them says, "Don't retaliate." And what they're talking is, if somebody sues you, you don't have to just turn around and countersue them. Because one, it's going to tie up more of your money. It's going to take more of your time. It may not be worth it if it's better just to
settle.
Maybe settle.
If you settle, you've got no life.
I understand.
You cannot be in business today and settle lawsuits. Because if you do, you'll have no insurance. You can't run a business without insurance against the law. You can't operate in anybody. You can't have customers because your customers. I've been trying to be sued because a guy ran over the light pole in my parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was because, well, I should have painted it with a glow-in-the-dark color. I said, that doesn't work if you have your lights on. I've had them try to sue me for name something. Now, how can I live in a society if I just let everybody who wants to sue me have it?
Well, and I understand that. Remember, I work at retail. How many people...
When they
have an intention
of when they come into your store and shoplift from you, does your boss turn around and give a second pair of whatever it is they sell? How long would you stay in business? What this cannot be.
Yeah. It's
exactly
not literal
the way it's stated.
It's not I don't think it can be
so
literal.
So my question is, how do you live with it? Or are we going to pass on because this is one that's too hard to talk about?
Well,
so
we're going to. I've still got some a little bit more to go into here. Maybe it'll answer the question, Walter.
I believe that the context there is a last resort. Like, we are in a litigious society today. Everybody's wanting to sue everybody. I think he's saying, hey, our lives are not to be characterized by that. But somebody comes after you like he's talking about, I think you've got the right to defend yourself.
Well, and again, I'm going to finish up what I'm talking here, and then I'm going to try to have some application that might help. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with them too. In their time and their culture, I mean, today, who's going to make you walk a mile with them? Make you walk a mile with them? Probably nobody. First of all, there's probably a few people that, for their health benefits, walk a mile.
Do you know the origin of that?
Yes, the Roman soldiers.
The Roman soldiers.
And that's what I'm getting to.
Today's equivalent of that would be the government forcing you to do something, and you say, okay, I'll do double that.
Or extra. Basically, that's exactly it. The Roman soldiers, and it wasn't just Rome. There was a lot. Assyria had the same thing. Babylon had the same thing. A lot of overtaking, conquering armies had the same policy. It's just that because Rome was in power at the time of Jesus, at the time of the New Testament was written, a lot of our reference goes back to Rome. Roman soldier could come up and say, hey, these bags are heavy. Alan, carry these for me for a mile. His answer to that would be, okay. I mean, he had no choice. Now, probably the only, some of the very few things that they would allow this conscript, because face it, you were drafted for a mile. One of the few things they would allow them to carry is probably their weapons. I mean, you don't give a weapon to somebody that you're occupying their homes and all of that. And if he happened to be going the same way as the soldier, that's okay, I'm going that way anyway. But what if he's coming the other way and the soldier says, nope, take care of my bags? it's out of his way. It's an inconvenience. But Jesus is saying, don't just go. And the Jews had stuff marked out. They actually had like mile markers, you know, stones, whatever, by the road. They get to that next mile marker, boom, done. See ya. That was it. Jesus is saying, go that second mile to show that the first mile was done willingly. Whether you were happy about it or not doesn't seem to come into the picture. But you were willing to be a servant. And I think that's one of the things Jesus teaches in a lot of places is a servant attitude. He teaches that we're not supposed to be focused only on the here and now, that sometimes we are going to suffer hardship. Nowhere do I see Jesus saying, don't defend your life in this passage. There are other places where Paul said, hey, it's better if I go and be with Jesus, but I'm going to stay here.
Jesus
so,
also said, take a sword with you when you go out.
To Peter, he said that when they went out. And then he said, those who live by the sword die by the sword. So there's a guideline here that Jesus is trying to teach in this contrast to take personal retaliation, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, is don't retaliate. Now, whether that's settling out of court, whether that's fighting back in court in the 21st century, I don't know the most correct answer for that. I know that God doesn't want us to constantly be bickering and doesn't want us to conform to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And sometimes that transformation may necessitate us, you know, having to swallow our pride, you know, sort of take it in the pocketbook. Now, again, that's a kind of maybe a harsh statement, but I think that sometimes that's part of what makes Christianity kind of difficult, is the expectations of us are more than the expectations of the scribes and Pharisees. They were, you know, they did things just exactly, that was it, that was the limit. Jesus says, go beyond that. Have the heart that goes beyond that.
Yeah, but so much back then, people lived off of fear. I mean, now we don't. A lot of people don't live off of fear, you know, even in the beginning, you know, there's, you're going to heaven or you're going to hell. You know, even to this day, a lot of people are baptized just because of the fear of they don't want to go to hell.
Right.
But, you know, there you take all that fear out of it, and
there's, there is an aspect of fear for some people. We have to respect what God asks of us, which may or may not be what we want.
You know, a friend of ours in Denver is a financial advisor, and on the question of how are you going to fund your retirement, he told us that the top two answers when he sits down with people and asks them, you know, what their plans for retirement, the top two answers are, one, they're going to win the lotto, two, they're going to sue somebody. And that is their, and they are dead serious. Their financial plan.
I hear you. I've heard that. I haven't heard it from the financial advisor I work with, but I've heard that people have that attitude or that approach. Is, and as a result, I think it makes it difficult for us.
Like I said before, I'm kind of simple-minded, but to me, these chapters immediately following the Beatitude is simply an expounding of the Beatitude. It's explaining to us how we got to live up to these Beatitudes to be blessed by God.
Okay, yeah, and that's kind of what this whole study that we're going to go through on Sermon on the Mount is. This is what a citizen of the kingdom, in our time, what a Christian looks like, is the Beatitudes. This is the blessings that are going to attach to characteristics, life choices, and then here's how you should live your life. Now, how many people in here live perfectly every single day in thought and deed? From the time they became a Christian until this minute? Nobody. We all struggle. We all have areas of weakness. This is, I believe, the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus saying, this is the picture of what it should look like to be a citizen of the kingdom. And part of that is going to be hard. He goes on to say, give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Give to him who asks you. I'm going to ask a question and I'll tell you what I think. What's the first thought that comes to your mind when somebody, when you hear, give to him who asks from you?
Panhandler on the street.
The guy on the corner, or gal on the corner, with the cardboard sign, is basically wanting something for nothing. That was the first thought that came to my mind. But what does Jesus say? Help him out. Doesn't say, study and determine if they're worthy of your generous largesse. Says help them out. Doesn't say fund their retirement. Help them out. I mean, that's kind of part of what Galatians 6:10, as you have opportunity to do good to all, especially those of the household of faith. So we should be especially sensitive to the needs of other Christians. But as you have opportunity, somebody standing on a corner begging for food, what can you do?
Give them a job.
You could give them a job. You could buy them lunch, as opposed to just giving them money. I mean, those are some options.
In the example that you just said,
mm-hmm.
If we're going to do that person good, then you don't give them anything. Because all of the charitable organizations, all of the foundations constantly say, please do not give these people money on the streets because they use it to buy alcohol and drugs and everything else. We have these shelters, we have these foundations they won't come to. Make them go there so they can get help. When you give them money on the street, you're actually hurting them. So,
you're enabling
point,
them.
Yeah,
and that's what I'm saying, don't give them money.
Good, or do you want to just...
But if somebody says, I'm hungry, how can you solve that problem? Is you could give them a sandwich, take them to Subway, take them to Burger King, McDonald's. You're not giving them money, you're solving what they said they have an issue with.
Didn't that kind of cover it in the parable of the Good Samaritan?
Partly, yes. I would say so. So, some final thoughts on this particular passage that I see. I see several, what I call seconds. Turn the second cheek. Give up the second article of clothing. Go the second mile. Again, I think it's Jesus telling us, them, who were dealing with, in their culture and in their day, eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, as personal retaliation was an ongoing and personal, actual thing. He's saying, don't retaliate. Don't respond in kind. The citizens of the kingdom, again, this is part of what Jesus has been talking about, is what that's going to look like, need to be ready to submit to sometimes unreasonable demands or expectations. The government saying, we're going to drill into your land whether you let us or not. We're going to take this money from you for taxes, and we're going to give it to people who don't want to work, whether you want it or not. That might be considered an unreasonable demand that the government would make on us. But Jesus said, pay taxes. You know. Citizens of the kingdom should willingly go above and beyond what's asked of them. Doesn't mean you have to give up the whole store. Sometimes it may mean fighting in court. I see that if you have a society of people insisting, and I have that in bold on my notes, insisting on their rights, and they're bent on revenge if they don't get what they want, is a society that's plummeting towards self-destruction. And if we look around us today, what do we see? Steep downhill slide. of our society, our culture. Rod?
In 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3, verse 10, for even when you were with me, I gave you this rule, the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat.
Okay.
In other words, I don't know how a lot of you are brought up, but I was brought up, you can always find a job. It may not be what you want to do, and it may not be get what you want to get paid, but you can find a job.
Okay. I understand and I agree with that. Now, contextually, what was Paul talking about there? He was talking about Christians that were waiting for the day of judgment. They were choosing not to work because they were waiting for Jesus to come back. So they were relying on their fellow Christians to support them. That's part of what was going on at that time in that exact context. So, but at the same time, because of all of our other passages that we read in the New Testament about being helpful, we can't overlook those either. Now, if we see the same person on the same corner day after day after day after day, we may want to think twice about buying him a sandwich a second or third or fourth time.
Offer to buy him food.
You know?
See what kind of reaction he gets.
You probably, oh no, that's okay, just give me the money.
I'll tell you for a fact.
You know, and that's, again, if you ask him about that, that's, again, would, you know, be a way to address that situation. Say, you know, what did Peter and John say to the guy that was asking for money? Asking for, he said, I don't have any silver or gold. I think in the, it says, silver and gold have I none. But what I do have, I give you. Now, because Peter was blessed by the Holy Spirit, by God, to be able to perform miracles, he could heal the guy. But what did he do? He told him about Jesus. You know, now, how might that be an opportunity? Encountering somebody that's begging, how might that be an opportunity for us to witness for Jesus? In our actions, in our lives, in our words?
Could this not just be a lesson in love, period? And showing people how the difference between being a non-Christian and not loving people, well, everybody loves. He talks later on about tax collectors and all of that. But at the very end of the chapter, he says, we need to be perfect just as Christ
just God is perfect. Right. Yeah.
So, what is perfect mentioned as in the Bible? What's perfection?
Different things. One
love
is completeness. Love is perfect.
And so, if you apply love to all of these different scenarios, you kind of answer the question.
Exactly. Now, we're kind of at the end of class. Believe it or not, intentions being what they are, I intended to get through that whole passage too, but I didn't. So we'll look at that next week on loving your enemies. And any other thoughts or questions here? We do have about 2 minutes left. So any other thoughts or questions about going the second mile, not retaliating, that concept, that thought? All right, let's be dismissed. We'll go ahead and get ready for worship.